Okay, so the schedule has an exam on Friday, and a help session needs to be scheduled, and there's been a suggestion to switch it to Monday. So the vote, I guess, is 3-0 in favor of keeping it on Friday. Or something like that. Okay, so it's Monday. With the warnings, right?
Yeah. Warnings are there.
And should we do a prep, like a study session still like this Thursday?
That seems early, because if you're not caught up, you're not caught up. I would say Saturday. But
Saturday will work.
Saturday, like later afternoon?
Anytime. Another option. Another option, which I don't really like, but could probably work, is like 9 o'clock on Sunday. Nine p.m.
I feel like we did one of those last year.
I don't like it because I'm traveling, so there could be all sorts of if, ands, or buts. Saturday, Sunday? What's the... So it can't be Saturday at 7. Can it be Saturday at 4?
Saturday at 4 would work for me. But I'm not...
5 in case the game goes late.
I have no intention of going to the game, so...
So Saturday after the game. Soon after the game. Is that... That would work? I guess the definition of what soon is.
I mean, the game's at 1, so it should be over by like 4 for sure, but I don't want to be like rushing after the game, I guess. I don't know, but that's just me. If anyone else has
Saturday at 4? Such strong opinions. The H-bomb. 57 commutation relations to be proved in 57 or fewer minutes. Okay, so I'm not sure how much of this I need to repeat because it works pretty easily, right? So if the Hamiltonian breaks up into two pieces, then we can use products of those pieces to get new solutions to the Hamiltonian separately. And the energies just add. And in the case of a free particle where the potential is zero, that would be true, right? Because momentum squareds are going to separate out. Projectile motion where we have different forces in the x direction, no force in the x direction, and gravity in the y direction, it would be true of that one. Isotropic simple harmonic oscillator, infinite square well, multiple non-interacting particles. Any case where the potential is going to break up into two pieces, this would apply. But that may look like a long list, but it's not going to apply to lots of things. I would say a typical thing, because typically we're going to think about the potential being a function of R, the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared, and that's not going to break up into a sum of pieces. So it's not going to apply to the hydrogen atom. It's not going to apply to what I would say a typical three-dimensional problem, but it does apply to this kind of long list. And since we knew solutions to the square well and the infinite, or to the isotropic simple harmonic oscillator, we could immediately write down what the solutions are in 2D, which is what we did, and it's not any more of a problem to do it in 3D. All we have to do is add more of those terms. One kind of funny thing is that in the case of the square well, we expect the solutions to look boxy, right, because it's in a box. In the simple harmonic oscillator case, they still look boxy, but this is isotropic, so we would kind of expect that the solutions would have circular symmetry. And what I promised you is that if we separate the problem in polar coordinates, it will have circular symmetry. And some linear combination of these boxy solutions have to be those circular solutions. So the boxiness is in some sense an artifact. Questions? Okay, so with three-dimensional problems, we're going to be very interested in symmetries because symmetries generate degeneracies. So you remember that if we have some quantity Q that commutes with a Hamiltonian, then we can generate new eigenfunctions just by having the Q operator operate. And kind of the and that's typically going to generate degeneracy, right? Two solutions that, two distinct wave functions that have different eigenenergies. And the example that you should keep in mind, if you can remember it, is the hydrogen atom. I mean, we will do this, but I would hope you would remember some of this from modern. The hydrogen energy wave functions had an energy that was this famous formula, minus 13.6 electron volts divided by the principal quantum number squared. And the states were labeled by the principal quantum number, the angular momentum, and the angular momentum in the z direction. So, for example, when n equals 3, there were a whole bunch of degenerate states. There were states that had L equals 2, and then M going anywhere from plus 2 to minus 2. So that's a total of 5 states. There are the P states, where L would go from plus 1 to minus 1, total of 3 states. And there were L equals 0 states, one of those. So lots of degenerate states and tied to angular momentum. So for the H atom and for lots of problems, they are rotationally symmetric. And so we expect angular momentum to be conserved, and conservation corresponds to the commutator being zero. So so we're going to be real interested in how the Hamiltonian relates to lots of these angular momentum sorts of operators. And of course, angular momentum is exactly what it was classically, except now when we write R cross P, what we mean by P is H bar over I grad. So the other kind of important factoid is we said that if we had a special case where the thing commuted and produced a multiple of Q, then we had a ladder situation where if psi was a eigenfunction that had energy E, then Q psi would have an energy that was E plus lambda. So we could make, if we can come up with commutation relations like this, we can make ladder operators that can move us around. And in the case of the book, for the simple harmonic oscillator, it came up with those sorts of things, and it decided to do the ladder operators first and the differential equation second. And for angular momentum, it's going to do the reverse, and I'm going to do the reverse. So I'm going to be stressing the operator method, whereas the book is going to proceed to talk about the differential equation method. And I could, if push come to shove, in tell you why that's the case, but maybe not now. So that's kind of the orientation. That's why we're interested in these angular momentum operators. And again, kind of qualitatively, remember we're thinking about these solutions being standing waves. And if we think about how standing waves are going to apply on the surface of a sphere, we're going to somehow or other divide the sphere up with nodes and antinodes all over the place. And I've promised you that the Legendre polynomials that we talked about last time, those things had a particular symmetry where they had so-called zonal symmetry. Those things only depended on, well, cosine of theta, right? So it was kind of a series of nodes and antinodes that were going this way. But obviously, if we're going to have a complete set of solutions, we're going to need to have oscillations that are going this way too. Right? So we should have all possible modes of oscillation on the surface of the sphere. So how it's going to turn out is that this angular momentum number L is kind of going to count the number of nodes that you have totally, and then how they are distributed, whether they are zonal, fully zonal like this, the way the Legendre polynomials are, those are going to correspond to M being 0. And as we move away from M equals zeros, we're going to start to pick up nodes going around in latitude. Okay, but kind of the same number of nodes for different values of L, just how they're distributed being different values for M. Okay, so that's kind of what we're interested in. How can we make a set of functions which could expand anything on the surface of the sphere, which are kind of like these standing waves? That's what we're after. And then we can use those for any potential that is spherically symmetric, whether it's infinite square well that is round, or whether it's simple harmonic oscillator, or whether it's the hydrogen atom. These things are going to come up all the time. So the upshot of all of this is that there are 27, I think, commutation relations which are pretty simple. And we're going to prove them, I hope, in a fairly compact fashion. But the way we prove them is not the way to think about them. So what I claim is that if we take the commutation relation using any particular component of angular momentum, where I would be 1, 2, or 3 for x, y, or z, and we commute that with any vector. So what are the vectors we know about now? Well, position, momentum, angular momentum. I think those are the only vectors we know. But if we come up with any vectors in the future, the same commutation will apply to them. That this thing here is equal to I. Remember, the I comes about basically automatically. There has to be an I. Because when you take the complex conjugate, you switch them around and it generates the minus sign. We need to have units from this angular momentum, and h bar is going to generate those units. And then what we're going to get is epsilon ijk xk. So remember that this thing here is the Levi-Leviche symbol. It's 0 if any of ij or k are repeated. And it's equal to plus 1 if ijk is a cyclical permutation of 1, 2, 3. So that means, for example, that 2, 3, 1, this symbol would be equal to plus 1. And if it's not a cyclical permutation of 1, 2, 3, then it's minus 1. And that epsilon was, or that Levi-Leviche symbol, is what was behind the cross product. Okay, so that's pretty easy to remember, but you can see there are a whole lot of possibilities, right? So there are three possibilities for this. For each one of these, there are three possibilities. So this is 27 commutation relations. Yes?
I guess, I don't know, maybe I'm just not seeing it right, but like, where would you get K in this problem?
I mean, K. What is, I don't see a K.
Like a K in your yeah. Or, so like you would have a set angular momentum and you'd have a set vector, but where would the K come from in the problem?
Okay, so for example, what this says is that L1, L2 has to equal I H bar L3.
Okay, I see.
Because the only thing that, if you want, you can think about K summing over everything, but the only thing that it's going to produce is the case where it's not zero. Okay, so here are a bunch of commutation relations. Another bunch of commutation relations is that if we put a scalar here, it's going to be zero. So what are the scalars that we know about? Well, we can take any x and dot it with any y, and that's a perfectly good scalar. All right, so there are three choices here, three choices here, three choices here, so there are another 27 commutation relations there. Okay, so a whole slew of commutation relations are required. What we want to do is to try and find a way of proving them that doesn't require 27 individual proofs. And what we're going to show is this thing at the top. That is to say that if I take some constant vector A and I dot it with the angular momentum, and I choose all three of the components of x at once, what I'm going to get is h bar over I A cross x. Okay, so for example, what this would, if I choose A to be the I vector, what this would say is that L1 commuting with x1 and L1 commuting with x2 and L1 commuting with x3 is equal to h bar over I. Well, what does this cross product produce? Well, the cross product, let's do it, 1, 0, 0, I'll just write them as x, y, and z. So in the x direction, it's going to produce 0. In the y direction, it's going to produce minus x3. And in the k direction, oops, did I do that wrong? So I should have that, which is minus x3. And in the k direction, it's going to be minus x2, plus x2, right? Okay. And of course, I've shown this for A being equal to the I vector. I can have A being equal to the J vector. I can have A being equal to the K vector. And I will run through all of these possibilities. Okay. Looks like I guess I have my sign right. Yeah, okay. Okay, so that's the plan, that this is a very compact way of writing what is in some sense more simply written there. And it allows us to prove lots of things at once. In fact, it allows us to prove all 27 at once. Well, excuse me, all 9 at once. We have to have x be some particular thing. Okay, well, let's see how far we can get with this. So what we have is A dot L, and we want to commute that with the R vector, the first thing that's on the list for X. And if we write down what that is, L is equal to R cross P. And now we have to remember this property of the cross product, that you can switch around the dots in the cross for free. So this is the same thing as the commutator of A cross R dotted with P R. Okay, so that dot product I can expand out as a sum. So in the next term, I'm using the Einstein summation notation, where Those J's are being summed over, but I'm not bothering to write the sum. Is that good? And R commutes with itself, right? So the R's can come out. And we know that PJ commutes with RI only if J equals I, right? Because if I take derivatives of Y with respect to Z, I'm going to get zero. So there I'm done with the first one. Okay. And you can see it's going to work the same but different for P. Because again, the P's all commute with each other, so the P's can come outside of that commutation. And we've got it for the P's. Now the L's are going to be more work because they include a cross product themselves. And what we're going to want to do is to, along the way, prove this commutation relation, which I think is one that was also in the homework. If I have A commuting with B times C, the claim is that this is the same as A commuting with B C plus B commute. Okay, so if I've written it down correctly, we'll see if we can prove it. So what this thing here is it's ABC minus BCA, right? I take this block and I put it here, or I put it in front of the A. So here what I've got is AB minus BA times C plus B times AC minus CA. Okay, so this term is that term, and this term is this term, and these two terms cancel. Okay, so we get this kind of funny distributive law, which is worth tattooing. Okay, so off to the races then, where this is operating on some component L sub I of the angular momentum vector. And remember that you can write cross products. So the ith component of A cross B is equal to add up over all jk, epsilon ijk, aj bk. I don't know if we are happy with that, so let's at least check out the case where I is equal to 1. So if I is equal to 1, J and K, the only things that are going to count is when J and K are 2 and 3 or 3 and 2. Right? Everything else is going to be 0. Because they have to be distinct from 1. So if they're exactly 2 and 3 in that order, then we're going to get A2 and B3. If they're switched, then they're going to be out of cyclic order, and we're going to get minus J is now equal to 3, B2. And that's exactly what we would get from the determinant, right?
So we're allowed both cases because we only know I? Is that kind of, like, you have to include both cases because we only know I?
Well, so this is kind of a funny way of doing things. There are only two terms, but I'm going to add up 9 terms. So this is a sum over all J and K. But when J or K is equal to 1, it's just going to give me 0. And if k happens to equal an earlier value of j, it's going to equal to 0. So out of these 9 terms, only 2 terms are going to contribute. So it seems like a bad idea to swap 2 terms for 9 terms, but it's not. Being able to write things in a compact form is better, even if there are more terms, is better than having lots of terms. Okay, so what I've got here then is epsilon ijk, and I'm going to be summing automatically over j and k because it's repeated, and I'm going to have a dot l commuting with r j p k. And now I can use that theorem over there. So this is epsilon ijk of a dot l commuting with rj multiplied by pk plus rj a dot l commuting with pk. Okay? So we know what those things are, right? This thing here is the jth component of A cross R sub J by the previous results, along with an H bar over I, right? And this thing here, again, the H bar over I, it's going to be A cross P, the kth component of it. I see happy, exciting, smiling faces. Like in 191, where we prove that constant force is 1/2 AT squared. Huh? That much interest. Okay, so what have we got here? So remember that this thing here is how you generate cross products. So what we have is the cross of this and that. So this term, overall factor of h bar over I, this term here is A cross R crossed into P. Yes? Maybe.
We're trying to pull that out of the same relationship you created with the A cross P thing.
So here's the definition of how the cross product works, right?
Yeah.
So here I have a J, just like AJ, and here I have a PK, just like B. And it all has this epsilon 1, 2, 3 with it. Yeah, so that's the earlier proof, right? So before that, we showed how A dot L commutes with R and how A dot L commutes with P. Okay, so the same game applies here, right? So what we've got here is R crossed A cross P. And then for that triple cross product, do you remember the back cab rule? So if we back cab those guys, we get what's on the second line. And that's the same thing that's on the third line.
So, could you give me an example of where, like, when we're going to use these sorts of things in a problem?
all the time.
I mean, like, I don't know, it's just, it's hard for me to, like, attach this to any sort of problem right now in my mind, I guess.
So the kind of context for this is to remember the A and the A dagger operators, right? So we were able to show from the A and the A dagger operators that the Hamiltonian operating on A produced, was this minus one or minus two? I think it was minus two times A, so that we could use A to lower the energy in the simple harmonic oscillator. And then those A's were then super useful if we wanted to calculate integrals of X's, right? Or maybe you haven't, maybe you're not there in the homework yet, but if you want to calculate expectation values of X, it's A plus A dagger, and you don't actually have to do any integrals to solve these problems. So the plan is exactly the same, except with angular momentum. Yeah, so what we're going to make is operators that I'm going to call L plus and L minus, which change the angular momentum. And if we want to calculate expectation values of, say, the angular momentum in the x direction, it turns out that this is basically L plus plus L minus.
So this, what we're doing now is kind of the groundwork for being able to say that L plus and L minus.
Yeah, so what I need to be able to do is to get to things like that. In order to get to things like that, I need commutation relations. So that's one reason to do that. And actually, in order to do that, we only need the commutation relation that we've just shown. Namely, that these L's have this property that if you take Li and Lj, what you get is IH. So you do notice a problem, right? So this I, that's the one that's the square root of minus 1. Every other I is an integer that is 1, 2, or 3. Yeah, yep. Any I that's not a sub, yes. I can't think of any exceptions. Any I that's not a subscript is the square root of minus one. That's really all we need. And that's really all the book proves. But it turns out that these things are all much more general, and I think it's useful to realize that they're more general. That is to say that the same relationship applies to P. It applies to X. It applies to any vector. And fundamentally, what's going on here is that this product, this operation, taking the commutator of L with something, is kind of generating a rotation. And since all vectors rotate the same way, every vector has to have the same sort of commutation relations. So in what sense what I just said is true, I'm not going to describe. But that's basically what's going on. The L's generate rotations. And any vector has to rotate the same way when you rotate coordinate systems. And so any vector has to have these same properties. And if you don't have a vector, now, if you have a dot product here, that's invariant under rotations, and that's why this thing is zero. So that's the deeper, I mean, we could just plow forward and prove exactly what we need for the raising and lowering operators, but the deeper truth is that L is generating rotations, and so all of these vectors have to go the same way. Okay, so what we have left to do is to take a look at any dot product. Okay, so what we want is, and again, we're using this A as just a way of doing three cases at once, where A is I, J, and K. We want to dot that with any dot product combination. So what this is, of course, is dot products are sums, and I'll write the sum explicitly just this once, of A dot L, and then we have this product of XY. We can use that theorem over there to break that up into two pieces. So this is XI A dot L commuting with Y plus A dot L commuting with X with YI. Okay, so by the theorem at the top, this is overall factor of H bar over I. And here what we're going to get is A cross Y, the ith component of it. And here, of course, what we're going to get is A cross X, the ith component of it with Y. Okay, so then we're on this last line, and those things cancel. They're going to give us zero. You know, maybe it's worth doing. So what this thing here is this is epsilon I epsilon ijk xi aj yk. And what this thing here is, so this is the cross product, the ith component of it. So ijk aj xk yi. And you notice that here we have I and K, and here we have K and I. So that switch in order is just going to give us a minus sign that's going to cancel those two guys out.
So the epsilon ijk will be, no matter what you choose for ijk, one will be positive, one will be negative, is that what you're saying?
Pretty much, but remember that ij and k are all being summed on, right? So all of those possibilities are there.
Okay, yeah. Is that, so the Einstein summation notation is just that, like, if you ever have subscripts, it's going to be a sum, basically?
So if you ever have a repeated subscript, it's going to be summed.
Like what would be an example of a non-repeated subscript?
Well, so like here at the top, I have A dot L dotted with A sub I. So there's only one there's only one I in that expression. So we're thinking that I is a fixed value. In contrast to down in the next line, J is a repeated index, so J is summed on.
And that's just because it shows up more than once? Like in the...
Yeah, yep. So by repeated, I just mean that there are two J's present.
Yeah, okay.
And it just turns out, anytime you have a sum, you have to be summing two things. So why write the sigma? So the story I was told, which I have never tried to verify, is that Einstein didn't come up with this. Einstein's printer came up with this. That the printer was tired of writing all of these sums. And he said, look, Einstein, every time you've got these two indices, you also have this sum. Can't we just simplify my typesetting? And this is, of course, when typesetting is by hand. So mathematical typesetting, they used to have to pay an extra for, because it's so much more difficult than typesetting, you know, something for the English department.
That'd be a really rough job. Typesetting giant mathematical documents.
for sure. And the sigma is kind of a mess, right? Because it's typically it's a little bit bigger, and it always is going to have subscripts and superscripts.
How do you even do subscripts and superscripts?
Yeah, you'd have to have, that would be really terrible. You'd have a whole set of different sigmas that you can use.
I don't know. I mean, there must be little bits of lead that fit in there. It's, you know, it's kind of unimaginable, right? So much easier with a laser printer. Okay, so I'm not sure if I've convinced you of anything here, proven anything, but the final result is simple and it's memorable, right? So the final result is this guy here, angular momentum commuting with any vector has to have this epsilon ijk in it, and angular momentum commuting with any dot product has to be zero. Okay, so what were, well, maybe it's best to try and cram all the bad stuff on one day. When Tyler's not here. Would have been even better if no one showed up. Well, you all know, people in 191 don't yet know that proofs are important. You all know that they are important. But in some sense, you don't need them to work the homework problems, right? So in some sense, they're not important.
I've been told they're important for 4 years.
Oh, you're not, you haven't been convinced yet. You're not supposed to tell me that. So this whole second page is a mess. And what it's trying to show is that we can write p squared as derivatives with respect to r and derivatives with respect to angle. And I don't know, the proof is here, and maybe this time I won't bother to go through it. Kind of what's going on. So the upshot of this is that, remember that p squared is a Laplacian. So this is saying that you can write the Laplacian as derivatives with respect to r plus a bunch of derivatives with respect to theta and phi. But just from units, you know that there has to be a 1 over r squared here, right? Because the units of Laplacian are inverse length, so it has to be like that. So it's pretty obvious that the Laplacian can be written as exactly like that. Angle stuff divided by r squared and then some r stuff. So kind of the interesting statement is that this angle stuff is angular momentum squared. It's exactly that same operator. And so the proof is here, the proof is there. Let's not bother to do the proof, but let's go back, see what you remember from a year ago, classical mechanics. Okay, so up until this second, all the L's, up until this second and 5 minutes from now into the future, all of the L's have been angular momentum. But for this once, let's let L be the Lagrangian from 191. So we're working things in 3D, but you remember this important theorem that if you have a central force, the angular momentum is going to be a constant. So you can just work in the plane of the orbit, and that's just a two-dimensional thing. So instead of having three-dimensional coordinates, I can just limit myself to polar coordinates. And so we know that the Lagrangian is kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, and we have the radial kinetic energy, and we have the angular kinetic energy. And of course, we have some potential that depends on position. So theta dot squared, yep. So this is r omega, right, which is the tangential speed. And they're perpendicular, so I can just add them up as squares. So the momentum in the radial direction, that was the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to r dot. Okay, so this is kind of dull. It's just mr dot. The momentum in the theta direction is the derivative of L with respect to theta dot, And so it's equal to mr squared theta dot. And it's exactly the same thing as the angular momentum. The fact that there isn't a theta in the Lagrangian, that it's a cyclic coordinate, tells you that the corresponding momentum has to be a constant, right? Because Lagrange's equation says that the derivative of the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the velocities have to be the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the angles. So no theta here, so this thing is a constant of the motion. So that means we can rewrite the energy in terms of that constant, right? So we have the kinetic energy plus the potential energy, but we can take this term, right, which is 1/2 m r squared theta dot squared, and I can rewrite it in terms of this constant angular momentum. So in order to make this look angular momentum-ish, I'm going to have to multiply and divide by mass, and I need another two r's here, right? So that I have exactly this thing squared up top. So this term is going to be the angular momentum squared divided by 2mr squared. So we have then that the kinetic energy is equal to radial kinetic energy plus angular momentum squared divided by 2mr squared. And this thing here went by the name of the centrifugal potential, and it played kind of a big role. And this is exactly the same thing that's happening for us in quantum mechanics. We're going to get the angular momentum squared operator on top of 2mr squared. Okay, but it takes a whole lot more work to do that because in classical mechanics, we don't care about the order of P and R. But in quantum mechanics, RP is different from PR, right? Because they don't commute. So it's a matter then of taking care of all of those commutation relations to finally end up with this thing at the bottom. That P squared is basically the radial kinetic energy plus angular momentum squared divided by r squared. Is that somewhat familiar? You're just as impressed with that as you were with the first page. What's on the second ugly, the ugliest page, which is the third page? I pretty much can't imagine why you would ever care. But if you actually wanted to get what these angular momentum operators are in terms of derivatives, there it is derived. We know that L squared is basically the angular part of the Laplacian, but you know, what is the formula for angular momentum in terms of the actual operators? There they are. And there's only one of them that's memorable. Only one of them that I do want you to remember. And that's that the angular momentum in the z direction is just derivatives with respect to phi. Right? So that kind of makes sense. Phi is going around this way in the simple sense. And corresponding angular momentum is just derivatives with respect to that angle. Well, probably the good news is I don't think I got to any homeworkable stuff. So I was working on homework. So we need to actually get raising and lowering operators to do stuff. But at least we have out of the way 57 commutators, which I can now pull out the hat and claim most anything since you all went to sleep for the proof. Yeah, I don't know. Can't say I didn't try.